Hi, this is Ken Butcher. Most of the interviews on this podcast have been one-on-one. For this episode, we had a live audience at the Novels and Novelty Bookstore to hear Dr. Jacob M. Appel. We have Dr. Jacob M. Appel with us here. He's a physician, a lawyer, a bioethicist, and we were talking before about a little bit about what that means and the kind of issues. He's a graduate of Brown University, Harvard University, Columbia School of Physicians and Surgeons. He's got an MFA from New York University. He writes for the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, many other publications. He's written novels and collections of short stories and plays. His work has received many awards, including being shortlisted for the O. Henry Award. His first novel won the 2012 Dundee International Book Prize. One of his short stories won the Hudson Prize. Is that right? So, and that's an abbreviated list of his accomplishments, believe me. So, when I was reading, actually, it was this collection of short stories, Miracles and Conundrums of the Secondary Planets. Of course, I knew I was going to interview you. So I had in the back of my mind some looking for questions to ask. And I came upon this quote, this line in one of your stories, which I thought would be a good question. And the line is, "Why the urge to know everything? Most people hardly know anything."
First, thank you for the introduction. I do want to mention that I did an event earlier this year, and someone came up to me at the beginning of the event, and she was clearly this well-dressed, rather well-off woman, and she said, "I've driven 2.5 hours to come hear you speak."
Wow.
And I first thought that's quite an honor, and then I thought, this woman is out of her mind. and then she tells me, "And I've read everything you've ever written. And now I know this woman is crazy." But we talk for a couple of minutes, and it becomes clear she's read nothing I've ever written. She's read everything written by a different author named Jacob Appel. And then I felt really, really badly.
Oh, man.
But the moral of the story is, I am only the second most famous Jacob Appel at this point. So I haven't accomplished that much. That being said, I'm a psychiatrist, so I sort of approach things from a psychodynamic or psychiatric point of view. And I think most writers write, and many people seek knowledge to overcome many of the deep inadequacies that they bring with them through life, whether it's the holes in one's childhood or the sense of not knowing something when you're 4 or 6, and maybe you don't even remember being told, "How could you not know that?" Mm-hmm. But I really believe that the quest for knowledge is to fill the void of what we didn't know.
So tell us about the latest books. You've got a number of books out. I've been able to read a couple of them, but tell us about your latest stuff.
Sure. So I have 2 story collections coming out this fall, which is very exciting for me and chronologically not very exciting for the publishers because they get to compete with each other. And you have to remember that for a writer, it's really exciting to have a new book out, and it's like having a child in the way. And for the publishers, there's a spring line of books and a fall line of books and then another spring line of books, and it's just like making raincoats. So that being said, I'm very excited. One is called Courophobia and Fata Morgana, words you should all remember from your SAT studying. Courophobia is the fear of clowns or mimes, and Fata Morgana are the mirages of land one sees in the Arctic. And the second one is a collection called The Topless Widow of Herkimer Street. The Topless Widow of Herkimer Street, which is the title story, is about an elderly woman who decides that at her age in life, she is going to make a statement about gender equality and start sunbathing topless on her front lawn. And her son, who is a rather starchy adult lawyer, has a very hard time grappling with this. So I'm very excited for both of them. I will mention both for your listening audience and for our audience here, since they don't have these books in stock. If you would like complimentary electronic copies, I will send out around an email list when we're done. Mm-hmm. And if your listeners would like a copy, they can email me, my full name, jacobmappel@gmail.com. I will send you an electronic copy for free. The only thing I've learned in my entire writing career is there is never a downside to giving away free books. Because the more books you give away, the more people say, "I like this author," and they come back and then they buy another book. if you only read my electronic book and you didn't like it and you don't come back and buy another book, then you were probably a bad customer to have to begin with, because you'd be a dissatisfied customer and wouldn't come back and buy something else.
And I would say, to plug his work, I would say you're probably a writer's writer. I think probably, I know I do, I'm betting other writers really appreciate your work. Do you find that to be the case?
Well, my mother would interpret that as a code word for unemployable. but I think I do
I think you've got a couple things to fall back
on. Yeah, it's my backup plan. but I do think, even though I am way below the radar screen in the larger world, that it is always thrilling when other writers I really admire either send me a note they've read my story, or on occasion actually come to one of my events and say, wow, I really like your work. And that there's nothing better than having somebody whose book you liked come to you one of your events and say, I like your book too.
You know, since you come from New York, we were kind of joking about comparing New York to Andersonville. What is the, I mean, I don't even know where you start with that one. But what I wanted to ask is, what is the book scene like? You obviously have all the big publishers there, but just at your local bookstore, what's it like there? Do you feel like you really have your hand on the pulse of things? The latest stuff?
Well, I do literally several hundred events a year, and I do a lot of them around the country, which I find very exciting. And I like doing events in places like Hendersonville far more than in places like New York,
mm-hmm.
for a handful of reasons. One is that if you come to Hendersonville, North Carolina, and people come out to hear you, unless you say something profoundly offensive, they're generally delighted to hear you. And they're glad that a writer from New York has come to North Carolina, and often they've read the book, and some of them even buy the book. In New York, they're all looking at you and thinking, this is not Philip Roth. Why am I here? I could be having sushi. I could be at the opera. If you do a bookstore event in New York, which I have done, and uh-huh. you do signings, people will come up to you, and they will say things like, you know, I'd like to read your book, but I'm not going to buy it. Can I have a copy? It's hard to imagine it happening anywhere else in the world. It's a little like going to the supermarket. I'm not going to buy the apples, but can I have some? Or people will look at your cover and they'll say, you know, I don't like your cover, and then just walk away.
Wow.
So it's a very different book culture. And I think that's because in New York, in some way, we're spoiled. We have all of these A-list writers, and they all do events, and uh-huh. I pick up the chaff. The analogy I would draw is that if you have a painting by a celebrated artist and you live in a small town, it will be the centerpiece of your museum. Mm-hmm. But if you put it in the Louvre or the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it's one of hundreds, and people just walk by it like it's furniture.
Right. Well, how do you tell people about your work? If someone says, what kind of stuff do you write? I mean, I was having trouble. It's not like a mystery genre. It's not like an easily described, for me, it wasn't an easily described genre to tell people about.
Well, it's in the realm of literary fiction, which is really where I'm writing. I think a lot of it is social satire, social commentary. I am far more influenced by the great comedies of manners. I would think of myself more as an heir to John Galsworthy or George Eliot. Not as good as they are, mm-hmm. but at least an heir to their view of the world than I would be to novels of ideas, Dostoevsky or Sartre.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my goal, and a lot of what I write is about urban life or suburban life, is to gently poke fun at the odd ways we lead our lives without realizing it, often by taking ordinary people and having things that are seemingly normal but slowly become abnormal happen to them. So a couple of examples. So I have a short story where a mother of a young girl is concerned that her daughter is too involved with the life of her imaginary friend. And after a while, we've all accepted this as an imaginary friend, then the imaginary friend's father shows up at their door one day and tries to seduce her. Or I have a couple who they can't agree on whether or not to adopt a baby, so they get a trial period. They adopt a hedgehog. Unfortunately, the hedgehog becomes clinically depressed and it starts tearing apart their marriage as they spend more and more on psychiatric care and interventions to cheer up the hedgehog.
I got through all the short stories in that book, and I'm about halfway through your first novel. But it seems like, and tell me if you think this is accurate or not, that it seemed like most of your short stories are sort of built around a metaphor. And so I wanted to see, since you've got so many degrees, we can ask you any kind of question. I was going to ask you kind of a psychological question. To what extent do you think metaphors are sort of hardwired into our brains? And so, is that where the power of them comes from?
So you've asked me a hard neuroscience question, and I did terribly in neuroscience in medical school. So I will pass on the biological basis for it. But I will say that I think metaphors are extraordinarily helpful ways of viewing the world. Mm-hmm. One of my goals in fiction is to make the familiar strange. And an easy way to do that is to put us in a world that is parallel to our own, or to give us an analogy that we can relate to. And that's a way of stepping back. And we do that all the time in medicine. It's part of clinical practice. We say, this case is like that case, or it's not like that case.
Mm-hmm.
And in law, for that matter, too.
And in science and in engineering.
Yeah. And it works well.
Yeah.
And I will add, the professionals who do that well are the ones we connect with. The doctor who says, rather than explaining some very complex formula, these are your kidneys. Picture them like two large beans. You easily understand. The person who starts drawing tubules and glomeruli, you roll your eyes and give up.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure it's the same in materials engineering.
Yeah. I thought, just to give, if you all haven't read some of these stories, just to give an example, he kind of goes on a far reach of a metaphor, or like an out. The example I would use is one of your first stories in this book. He has a shy guy in the South, in Louisiana, I think, and he's got a restaurant. He's running a restaurant, and he runs into this girl, and he's attracted to her, and she's attracted to him, but he doesn't feel right about it. So that would be one way to write the story. But in Jacob's story, the guy is an alien from another planet. But the cool thing is, I mean, he starts out, he's an alien from another planet, and you think, well, where's this going to go? But then his reactions are the same as any shy guy that ever felt shy around a girl. And it's very charming, I thought.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. But you don't want to read into the story about the shy guy who falls in love with a girl who may or may not be interested. But if that shy guy is an alien sent to be inconspicuous, so he becomes a Latvian restaurant owner in a small town in Alabama, thinking he will be able to observe human life in its normal form. And the day after he opens his Latvian restaurant, an abortion clinic opens up next door and they start protesting. Then we've hooked you into a story that distracts you from what I'm really trying to tell you about romance and shyness.
And it sounds like with all those elements, it's going to be this outlandish thing, but it isn't. It's like a very natural feeling and recognizable. All the emotions are very recognizable, and I think it's great.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that's what makes great literature. It's not reading about people you know. It's when you read Pride and Prejudice and she has the suitor, Mr. Collins, who is a long-winded bore, and you say, wow, my uncle is just like that. Even though you have no connection with 18th century Britain, that's what makes the difference.
Yeah. So let me ask you this about your writing. How does it feel? How does it fit into the rest of your life? Is it sort of a seamless part of the rest of your life, or is it a sort of an escape from the other things you do? How do you feel about that?
The way I would describe it is that I spend most of my days as a psychiatrist, hearing the most outlandish stories you could ever possibly imagine. And then I can't tell them to anyone. And I certainly can't write about them. So I have to come up with stories that are equally imaginative in the opposite direction. My favorite joke, and I can tell a joke on radio, I guess, is about this rabbi who decides he's going to play golf on Yom Kippur, the holiest of Jewish holidays. And he starts playing golf, and he scores a perfect shot on every hole. And the angels come up to God and said, God, what are you doing? This rabbi is committing the worst sin he possibly can, and he just scored a perfect game. And God says, yes, but who can he tell? And that is my career.
And so let me change gears a little bit and just ask some of the nuts and bolts kind of questions about your writing. You write how frequently? Every day?
Probably 3 or 4 days a week. I try to get a block of writing time. One thing I've learned how to do is to write in the hospital.
Really?
I discovered I'm not alone. So when you go to the hospital to visit your ill relative and you see all those doctors and the nursing stations typing away and you think how wonderful they're working on patients' charts, half of them are working on their next novel, their latest poem. It's actually a terrible story, but not that terrible. So once while I was doing that, a patient actually coded in the room right in front of mine, and they have like their crash carts coming in and they're shouting for medication, and I'm sitting there looking up from my computer trying to be as inconspicuous as possible.
And did you write, how long have you been writing? All the way through school or?
So I guess I started writing seriously when I was in law school, which is now 23, 24 years ago, a while ago now. Mm-hmm. What I tell people is anybody who's been to law school who very early on doesn't try to think of something else to do with their time clearly hasn't paid enough attention. So that was sort of the driving force, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I'd always written before that. I just hadn't thought of it in professional terms.
Mm-hmm.
And my big break occurred in 1998. I won the Boston Review Short Fiction Contest. It was the first time anybody had paid me a substantial amount of money for my writing. I did a fancy reading at Waterstone Books. What was really interesting about it is the story that won this contest that is actually in that collection.
Mm-hmm.
I'd submitted to 78 other publications and it had been turned down. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that's remarkable is one of those 78 publications was the Boston Review.
Uh-huh.
And that is why perseverance is the key to writing.
Wow. Which story was that?
A Shell Game with Organs.
Okay.
It's about a man whose girlfriend wants him to donate a kidney to her. And that is sort of the litmus test for their relationship.
And when you're in writing mode, do you have specific goals? You say, I'm going to write 1,000 words a day or finish this story by the end of the day, or do you just kind of let it flow?
So I write in scenes, and I think if anybody in the audience is thinking about writing, I think the best way, unless you have your own foolproof method, the best way to write anything is to figure out this is what's going to happen in each scene and then write one scene at a time.
Mm-hmm.
More people struggle with writing because they write too much at a time. They try to plow through to the next moment.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I realize I'm not really on or I'm starting to flag, I just stop.
Mm-hmm.
So if it turns out I only wrote an hour that day and my mind just wasn't focused for more, mm-hmm. that's where I stop. And that works for me at least.
And talk to me about your editing process. I'm in the process of editing a book right now, so I've got a special interest in that.
I do most of my editing along the way.
Uh-huh.
One of my rules for writing, certainly a short story and usually a novel, is I read the entire work through before I start writing. So when I was writing like a 400-page novel or a 300-page novel, I would actually spend the first 2 hours of my writing process reading 80 pages that came before.
Okay.
And then changing along the way, not just line edits, but making large changes.
Right.
So by the time I get to the end of a story, I've really done about 90% of the editing.
Okay.
I'll still need to go through and do some line editing and improve the language,
mm-hmm.
but I shouldn't have to do something large and conceptual.
Okay.
If I get to the end and there's still a large conceptual problem, it probably means the story isn't going to work.
Right.
And then I should know enough to put it away and not keep pursuing it. It is a very American belief that every story is perfectible, or every story, if you revised it enough, would be publishable. And I don't believe that. I think every person out there has a story worth telling that they can make work as a story, but not every story they have is one worth telling.
Is that tough to do? Did you have to discipline yourself to do that? Or
I think you get enough rejection letters and it tells you. I do. I am very proud of this. I have 21,000 rejection letters.
Oh, wow.
I've been interviewed many times about my rejection letter collection. I don't have all of them physically anymore. The woman I was dating for a number of years made it quite clear that either the rejection letters went or she went because she felt they were a fire hazard and we were all going to die in a giant inferno of rejection. So I've saved the great ones. I've saved the threatening ones, the ones from famous people.
Mm-hmm.
But no, rejection is a powerful motivating force.
So I wanted to get to, that's the sort of nuts and bolts, and there's all kinds of practical advice you hear about writing, but sooner or later you reach this almost mystical point or point that's hard to describe where do the ideas come from, you know, and how much does it feel like, how does it feel to you, and how do you think about it as a psychiatrist and otherwise, about this line where you sit down and write and you don't even know where that idea came from.
Well, there used to be a pitcher for the New York Mets in the early 1960s, this guy named Jay Hook, and his only significance in the history of the world was he'd gotten, I believe, a master's thesis from Yale on the nature of the curveball. And the Mets manager, Casey Stengel, at the time was quoted, probably much to his regret, as saying, "The man knows everything about a curveball except how to throw one." Hmm. And I think there's some truth in that about writing, too, that you can learn all the craft, and the craft is necessary, but then at some point, like in that famous cartoon where the mathematical squiggle is on the chalkboard, a miracle happens here. Mm-hmm. And most of my writing experience is writing the story, and while I'm doing that, periodically thinking, I hope this works. I hope that miracle happens. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know until you taste the pudding in the end. Mm-hmm. And I would say 2/3 of the time, you write a story, and at the end you think, yeah, this is perfectly competent. And nobody really wants to read a competent short story.
Right.
Like, you'd really like to have a competent dentist. You don't want to have a deeply imaginative dentist who thinks outside the box and experiments anew. But you don't want that in a short story. And for me, at least, I don't know until I'm done.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of it is discouraging as you read your story after it's done and you think, wow, I wasted all those months working on this. But then occasionally, you'll put the story down for a few weeks after you finish and you'll come back and you think, wow, I have no idea how I wrote that. And you'll be awed at being able to do it. And that's the joy.
Do you ever find yourself in the process of writing, like, where did that come from? Or are you more of a deliberate, intentional, planning sort of writer?
I'm pretty deliberate in terms of the structure, but often things will happen in terms of the individual details.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I will have friends or family or people I know read the book, and they will say, "Oh, this is clearly based on cousin so and so's experience with the well." And I will think, "Yeah, you're probably right," even though I vaguely remembered that cousin so-and-so had any encounter with a whale.
Uh-huh.
So things do lace their way in. As a psychiatrist, that's a bit unnerving for me because I'm always worried that something that somebody shared with me in clinic will appear, even though I have no intention of doing it. And even more concerning is that you won't do that, but somebody will see it anyway. I have a colleague who will remain nameless who is quite insistent that a character in my first novel is based on him, even though I met him after I'd completed the novel.
Right.
And even though I've proven this to him, I've actually shown him when the novel was written and when I met him, he cannot accept it.
Right. Yeah, I definitely have had the experience, you know, since my first novel set locally here, I had several people come up to me and say, "Oh, I see you put me in your novel. You know, are you going to share your royalties with me?" And I always wonder, which character did they think that they were?
I think the famous case of this that I enjoy, Andre Aciman, who's a writer I really admire, Egyptian-American, wrote Out of Egypt, which is a memoir about his grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, some guy in Egypt has been suing him, claiming that the novel is about this guy's grandfather in Egypt, who Aciman knows nothing about.
Right. I should stop asking questions and let you guys in the audience ask some questions.
So the short story that you were talking about, the Latvian grocer, when you say that you typically have a structure in mind. So what was the structure in mind for that story? So
first I need a problem. And at the simple level, the problem is going to be, or a log line, what I described. A alien is sent to observe human nature, and then an unpredictable phenomenon arises. And I decide next the unpredictable phenomenon will be the abortion clinic. So then I have the romance story, the improbable alien story, the abortion story, and then I need a narrative. I need an obstacle. And usually the obstacle becomes the structure. And the obstacle here will be this man desperately trying to maintain neutrality about a subject very controversial that he really knows nothing about, because on his planet, not only do abortions not exist, but neither sex nor childbirth exist. So he's somewhat befuddled. And at the same time, he very much wants to make a good impression on this young woman who is a protester on one or the other side of this issue. And so that conflict is what drives the story. And in most of my stories, I try to create a character who has some kind of ethical dilemma, usually one that confronts what he thinks is the right thing to do with what he or she thinks serves his own interest. And that, I think, most ethical dilemmas by nature occur when what we want to do and what we should do don't coincide.
What about structuring your novels? Is that a different process for you? Do you outline the novels? Do you have to get more, you know, organized on those? Or
I certainly conceptually outline them, so I have a pretty good sense of what's going to happen in the end before I start. I know there are writing teachers who say you should just start writing and let things happen the way they happen. There are a few brilliant people for whom that works. But the analogy I like to use to metaphors, this is a good metaphor for me. There are two ways of taking your family on vacation. You can decide where you want to go, you can make a hotel reservation, you can buy plane tickets, and you can end up in Disney World. Or you can pile your family into the back of your car and you can just start driving. And you might end up at Disney World, or you might end up with a bunch of very unhappy children. And so I think it's very important to have some sense of a target, and then some targets along the way of different major events that are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of have, like, if it's a ski slope, I have my different curves in the ski slope mapped out. And small twists may occur along the way, but nothing radically dramatic that I haven't anticipated is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If something that wild happens, I've done something wrong.
What are you working on right now?
So on the one hand, I should say my agent has two new novels on her desk that we have been unable to sell. So if anybody out there listening would like to buy a book, please feel free to reach out to me. And I've also written probably the thing I'm most proud of, which we have not been able to sell at all, is a book of ethical dilemmas. So I've taken 101 of the most interesting ethical dilemmas from modern medicine, modern science, and written both the problem or the question, and then it's non-normative. I don't tell you what I think about it. I offer you different viewpoints on how different thinkers, philosophers, sometimes even celebrities have offered their views on how to solve this problem. And I think it's like a good mind teaser for your family.
Good example one of the things in there.
Sure. So the first one in the book is a classic example from the hospital. Is a patient walks into the hospital with a bullet wound in his stomach, and he says, "Please treat me, I don't want to die, but I'd rather die than be treated by a black or a Jewish doctor." And then he passes out cold. And obviously there are three different choices for the hospital, in theory. They could honor his wish and not treat him that way, treat him with any doctor, they could let him die. They could accommodate his wish and find a white Gentile doctor, or they could ignore his wish but treat him anyway with whichever doctor they have on hand who may be black or Jewish. This is a great way to introduce the medical students to these issues. And once they take a stand, and obviously most people find this viewpoint rather disturbing, many will find it repugnant. But then you ask them about the 17-year-old Cambodian immigrant who wants a female obstetrician to deliver her baby, which seems far more reasonable to a lot of people. Or the African-American criminal defendant who says he wants a black forensic psychiatrist to do his evaluation because a white psychiatrist can't really understand what he's been through. And my favorite, because we've had both of these, you get the male urology patient who says he wants a male urologist because he doesn't want women touching certain parts of his body, and a different male urology patient who says that he wants a male urologist because everyone knows that men cut straighter. Now, those are the same – that's obviously not true. But those are the same scenario, but very different motivations. So the book grapples with starting off with a dilemma and then showing you the different permutations of where it might take you. And while the initial question may be fairly easy for some people, as you move along, the permutations get harder and harder.
And how many of those do you have in the book?
101. I could actually probably come up with many, many more, but the decision...
Is that the book that one of the books you're having trouble marketing?
I am having
it sounds like a fascinating book to me.
So unfortunately, and we have our bookseller here, so I won't put her on the spot, but I will say the problem we have had is the book has done very well on the editorial side. And so I've met with a number of people at big houses. And on the marketing side, people point out there is no bookshelf for ethics books in a bookstore. Mm-hmm. And we really don't have a mechanism for marketing a book in this niche. So if you were a household celebrity, we could make it a one-off event, but since you're not, we will anticipate losing a lot of money for a project that has no follow-up.
Interesting. So any other questions from the floor?
I was interested when you said the story that the Boston Review accepted, but they had rejected it earlier, plus 78 other rejections. Did you revise it as you were continuing to send it out to those 78 people, or was it simultaneous, or was it really the same story that you just kept sending out without revision?
It was the identical story. One of the lessons I've learned is it's a mistake not to take advice from people, but you should only take advice, literally speaking, from people who have a vested interest in your writing or your welfare. So when your spouse reads your story and says, I think you should do X, assuming your spouse is working for your own best interest, that's good advice to take. If you have a writing group of people you know well, you take a class and the professor is vested in you. When some random person writes you a note and says, this is what's wrong with your story, people often have a desire to offer their random opinions about things when their wisdom is no greater than yours. And had you submitted the story the way they told you to, there's a good chance they would have written you back and told you to do it the first way.
Do you have any, since you are in the hotbed of publishing, do you have any books to recommend to us that we don't know about yet?
In terms of fiction or in terms of...
Fiction or...
Not craft. A problem is with publishing. I read books all the time that I think are absolutely wonderful that get no traction whatsoever. And then you go into bookstores and there are shelves full of books that nobody in their right mind would ever read that someone has decided are going to make a large profit. The best panel I ever went to, by the way, and then I'll share a few books I really admire, was... Five editors, it was New Orleans at Words and Music, five editors, I believe, who had turned down The Life of Pi. And all of them said roughly, which I think is a wonderful book, and all of them said roughly the same thing. I thought this was one of the best books I had ever read in my life, but I was sure nobody else was going to think that. And that demonstrates what's wrong with publishing, because Coca-Cola can tell you exactly what kind of person in which location buys Cherry Coke versus Diet Lemon Coke. They know their product and their market to the last iota. And the movie industry, when they screen the movie, they get a focus group. If things don't work, they then remake the movie. In publishing, people who don't have much global experience or data work on instinct, whim, this worked last time, it might work this time, even though a lot of that data is out there. And often the result is that books that are wonderful don't get much attention. So I will offer you one example. This is in North Carolina. Writer who I really admire. So Lindsay Stark had a book out earlier this year, I think it's LindseyStark, called Noah's Wife. It is a book about a small town, presumably in North Carolina, where it has not stopped raining. And it is very loosely a reinterpretation of the Noah story from the Bible, and a minister named Noah has come to help the town and has to struggle against these town people who are despairing over the rain. A great literary novel that unfortunately was marketed as Christian fiction, which it is not. So if you look at the Amazon reviews, they say things like, I can't believe there's profanity in this book, or there's a sex scene in this book. So that's one book that comes to mind that I just thought was absolutely wonderful.
Okay, great. Any other questions before we wrap up? I always like to ask authors, for people that want to follow your writing, what's the best way to do that? Do you have a website?
I do have a website, which is www.jacobmappel.com. And my email is listed there as well. And generally, if you write to me and you ask for a copy of one of my books electronically, unless you say something profoundly disturbing in your email, I'm glad to send you a copy. What I ask is that if I do that and you enjoy the book, if you want to buy a second one, you don't go on Amazon and buy it, but you go to your local bookstore and buy one. And I also ask that if you really enjoy the book, you recommend it to your local library to purchase.
Great. Great. Well, thank you very much, Jacob. I really enjoyed it, and best of luck with all your writing and everything else.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Jacob Appel and the Novels and Novelty Bookstore. To listen to other episodes, or to sign up for our podcast, you can visit us at themiddleoftheair.com. See you next time.